Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, for another episode of the Panoramic Outdoors Podcast. Tune in to episode 65 today here, and on the intro, we're sitting down with Tristan, myself, and Sheldon. Sheldon's over in Brandon right now, tuning in remotely. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, man, things have been not too bad. Pretty good. I've been sitting a lot in the tree stands looking for my white-tailed deer. Got a couple good stories. Maybe I can start off with them before we get going. But the other day, if you want to hear them or not, I'm going to tell them. So the other day on Sunday morning, I went for a sit, and it was a really crappy morning. It was kind of raining and, you know, like windy. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to sneak out to the stand kind of earlier than I normally do. And I snuck in there and I got into the stand and kind of got situated. Started playing solitaire on my phone. Oh, before I started playing solitaire, I had one of those scent sticks, so I lit that probably like half hour or so before legal light, maybe a little bit longer, and playing solitaire. Had the windows open in my shack that I was sitting in, and on the downside of the wind, so it wasn't windy in there, and all of a sudden I heard a grunt, then I heard another grunt, and I'm like looking, I can see down the trail, like let's say to the west of me, about 100 yards, you can see that far, but obviously it's dark, so you can't see at this time, but you could almost see like a shadow coming down the trail. So I obviously got pretty excited, like, oh my god, there's a buck coming, you know. And so put my phone away and I look, or turned off solitaire and looked at what time it was, and it was like 2 or 3 minutes to 7, and legal shooting time 7:10, 7:11, 7:12, somewhere around there where I hunt. And so I'm sitting there, and then he comes out. He's standing about 50 yards from my stand, just stand there, mess around, kind of like grazing and stuff on some twigs or whatever was in the bush. And then he came out to this fall rye field, which is now like 30 yards to my stand. I'm watching him, and I look at my clock, and it's like 7 after 7 at this time. And I'm like, okay, I need at least 5 more minutes. And I could tell, I could look, like, see him. He was a nice big body, thick neck. He was in rut and a nice frame, but I couldn't really tell how big he was and if it fitted, like, in quotations, the profile of the buck that I'm kind of looking for. So I never took the shot. The buck ended up turning around and taking off, just walking away. And I had to let him walk. Just wasn't, wasn't legal shooting light. B, I wasn't 100% sure what kind of deer, profile wise it was. And yeah, it was kind of a heartbreaking moment. And then sat around for a little bit, and you know, things weren't really happening for me, so I'm like, yeah, whatever, I'm gonna rattle a few times here. And in the shack that I'm sitting in, I can't take the rattling horns out the window, so I gotta open the door, which is like stupid, but anyways, I did it and open the door, rattle, looking to the west again down this trail, just to, that's where I thought they'd come out. Nothing's happening. And then I look to the south, and there's a deer like running towards me across the field from a spot I didn't think there would be really deer, because there's a house over there and like other stuff within that mile. So didn't think deer would be coming from that direction. But yeah, and then he just busted me like right away quick, because I had to shut the door or try to like sneak basically back into the shack. So it was a very exciting morning for me on Sunday there. But I had a few kind of notes that I just like noted in my head for learn from your mistakes. Is number one, when you burn a scent stick, I think it's probably smart not to burn it, you know, an hour before legal light, because you don't know really what's standing like near you. And then the other things, of course, too, is like do your due diligence when it comes to, you know, your right hunting times and knowing exactly what you're shooting, I think is a good note to put for anybody that's listening. And if you're rattling, have patience and make sure the coast is clear, I guess, before you start doing that.
Did you have the scent stick lit inside the shooting shack or outside of the shooting shack?
I lit it inside and then like had it out the window.
I'm just kidding.
Well, and the thing was, is I didn't have like the best wind either. Like it was good. It was decent wind, but it wasn't the best wind. So I kind of was using the stick kind of as a cover as well. I wasn't necessarily looking for it to actually attract a buck in. And to be honest with you, I haven't really had them work like that before. So I was more or less just trying to cover scent, and I think it worked. Like, I mean, the buck came down the trail. There's really no other deer that I knew of in the area. I don't know why he'd be grunting like that, but it was pretty cool. It was first for me, I guess.
That's sweet. I've been lacing on a lot of the old cover scent with Tink 69 lately, and I'm getting a quick reminder why I don't enjoy using that stuff so much, especially tonight. I was driving home from hunting, and it was just like a Tank 69 bomb in my truck, and somehow, I have no idea how it happened, but I got some on like the sleeve of my jacket somehow, like right on the wrist cuffs. So I'm just like, I thought it was on my boots, and I get to my truck, and I'm like freezing cold. So I hop in and I crank the heat right away, and then that just like amplifies the putridness of the Tank 69. And so then I turn off the feet warmers in my truck, or the vents to my feet in the truck, and then I'm like still like, man, I can still like really smell this very strong somewhere, and I just like went to scratch my nose or something, and just like figured out it was on the cuff of my clothes. So I'm going out again tomorrow. So I didn't like throw my clothes in the wash or anything. I just hung them outside, and I'm going to have to deal with that tomorrow. But yeah, it's not a pleasant odor to be lingering around.
Yeah, I got kicked off the couch last night because I smelled way too much like don't eat. it has to smell like some sort of deer orgy up in there, because like Chase and I have been just laying down. We haven't been communicating. I think we went a little heavy on the old eau de estrus kind of scenario here.
Yeah, super heavy.
And a pro tip from a non-pro is take off your gloves when you're going to spray like a buck bomb of any type, because if you get it on your gloves, then you're really kind of screwed every time your nose itches. So
yeah, totally. Man, I can't believe how much those buck bombs are, how much they cost. But I do hear that they work pretty well, so. You know what I mean?
I've never tried pricing them out. I just meant like, I never meant to actually reference buck bomb, but just like any kind of scent you're using with your, you know, pointer finger spray or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
I've made that mistake using my gloves a few times, and then it's all over them, and yeah, it's not
good
fun.
Good point. Tristan, what have you been up to?
You and I have been hunting that egg land there quite frequently, and it's almost mind-numbing how we haven't had an opportunity to draw back on something yet. It's been a little frustrating.
Like on a decent buck.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I haven't even seen a buck, to be honest. And I'm probably about 10 sits deep. So I'm wondering if it's me. Maybe I look funny up in a tree. Although I was in the blind a few times. I don't know what's going on. But
it could or couldn't be your Instagram stories.
You know what? I'm pretty sure that would bring deer in, but it keeps me focused and energized for the hunt, for sure.
One cool thing I want to talk about that kind of made a difference in my hunt today is I got this new piece of clothing on, and I didn't know what to think of it when I first got it. It's a merino wool layer. It's called Wool Love. And I got like a pants on, like a whatever, long johns on, I guess you call them, and an upper with the zipper on it. And I'm already in love with this stuff, man. It's like a super light layer, and I've never had one of these before. So what I did with it, today was a bit cooler of a day, super like piercing wind out there, and I was going to go set up a new tree stand. So I always get pretty hot and sweated up when I'm setting up a new stand. And my old stuff, it's also some heavier wool stuff, but it also seems to like hold on to the moisture a lot longer. So today I set up, sweated, walked back, grabbed my gear, and walked into the tree stand, and I'm like, I'm wet from sweat. Like my body was wet, but like this Wool Love, like I've never had something like wick away moisture like that and like dry within minutes. And it was such a game changer today being out in that cold weather. And for those folks that are listening that don't know much about merino wool is antimicrobial. So Wool Love is antimicrobial, which means like when you sweat in it, the bacteria doesn't grow in there and it doesn't stink. So this, like these Wool Love layers that I'm wearing are like going to be, I can see them very fastly becoming one of my favorite pieces of clothing, A, because I won't be smelly, and B, I think I'm going to be able to utilize these like 90% of the year, besides maybe when it's like plus 40 out. I might not. I don't know. Maybe they'll work good. But they're designed to keep you cool in the heat and warm in the cold too. So that's pretty cool. If you guys are, if anyone's interested in checking some of this stuff out, go to wool.love and you can use our promo code panoramic10 for 10% off. But if you really want to get into it, you can also get some bundles. They have some great deals on bundling a bunch of clothing together. And I think you can get up to like 25% off. So they got some great deals, Canadian company. And man, this is super quality stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to add on to that too, Chase. But with those bundles, I'm pretty sure if you use our promo code on top of that, we get 10% off the entire store. So technically, I think it may be 35% off.
Oh.
Might have to correct me if I'm wrong. The other thing I want to add on too about this Wool Love is I've been kind of in my profession, I've worked outside basically since I was like 22 years old and working in some of the worst days. And one of the biggest mistakes I've made for probably the first 2 or 3 years in my profession was I cheaped out on the first kind of base layer type of clothing. But like with Wool Love and their socks, their layering kind of system as in their first layer, this stuff is a game changer. And I'm excited to actually not only use it in the tree stand, but, you know, ice fishing, everything else like you were saying there, Chase. So yeah, check that out. We love it. So we'll love it.
Ah, that's awesome. Yeah. What, are you guys ready to hop into like a little bit of turntable grill and tap? What are you thinking?
I'm ready to rock. Tristan, are you there ready to rock or what?
I'm excited and can't wait to start talking food and beverages.
You sound excited. All right, so let's start off with what's on the tap, because I mean, after a long day in the tree stand, I usually like to talk about maybe like have a beer or a shot or something when I get back. What's on the tap for you this week, Sheldon?
What's on the tap this week? I'm actually going to throw it to a little bit of red wine action. I don't know if I've ever talked about my red wine and how I like to have a few glasses here and there, but Chase and I have dabbled into this bottle called Sterling. I think I have talked about it. I'm going to use it again because I did have a couple drinks the other night paired with some deer heart that I'm going to talk about later on. But yeah, Sterling. So I think it's called Harvest Collection or Silver Collection. Very good wine if you see it on your... see it out there, try it out, because I like it. So
that's a good one. I do like that. Tristan, what's on your tap this week?
I turned it back and went to something I enjoyed in my youth, and that was Alexander Keith's Red, and that one's from the bottle. So I'm not sure about you guys, but I do find there's a difference when you enjoy your bubbly pops between a can and a bottle.
Big time. Big time.
Oh, 100% agree. 100% agree. I always say when I go to like camps, you know, when you got to haul in some beer to go to camp or whatever, I would say, man, it'd be so sweet if we could haul in bottles and it actually being like an effective way to bring in something. But obviously it doesn't work that well. You always have to bring cans. But yeah, a nice cold bottled beer sure goes a long way after a hot day.
Man, we used to drink a lot of Red, Alexander Keith's Red back in the day. And that's... interesting that you say that. I'm going to throw back too to the old good old 83. Had a couple,
oh boy,
Ryan Cokes the other day, and you know, that's just a solid all around kind of go to. It's Jody's number one go to drink, so it's something I don't get the finger wag for bringing home and putting in the liquor cabinet. So yeah, enjoy that. Moving on to the turntable, we'll go with Sheldon. Do you want to start back out with what you're listening to this week?
Yeah, you bet. I'd love to hit the Del Barber train yet again, but I'm not gonna. Our last podcast with him really made me open up his all the albums I've downloaded and got to listen to a lot of his music. But I went with this band called Royal Blood. They have a song called "Trouble's Coming," and it's actually like a modern like rock song. I got into something weird the other weekend. I was kind of bored and I had to put on a lot of miles. So I was bringing up this new music playlist type stuff. And this song came up and it's got a cool beat and I don't know, kind of like it. So that's why I've been listening to it quite a few times going out to the deer stand.
Nice. I will go second on this one, and one of the more frequent artists that pops up in my playlist is Tyler Childers, and well, I guess not more frequent, but it's like a solid go-to for me. And the other day I picked up the old guitar for the first time in literally months, and I played a couple of his tunes. Now, before everyone gets all crazy and be like, hey Chase, can you come play at my birthday party, at my wedding, whatever it
might be. My bachelorette party.
Yeah. It's not going to happen.
Don't you get that a lot, bachelorette parties?
Yeah. It's not going to happen because I'm not actually that good. I'm like the guy that just like screams and plays and doesn't sound good, but just enjoys doing it. So
you're like my 7-year-old niece that thinks she knows how to play guitar.
Exactly. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm not too sure if I can play guitar better or sing better, but I know my kids have a blast listening to me, so that's all right. Anyways, Tristan, what's on your turntable this week?
You know what? I'm gonna reference Dell again, but not because I'm gonna say I've been listening to Dell, even though I have. Dell started turning me on to a few musicians, and one of them is Paul Cawthon, and guy's got a really interesting sound. Definitely twangy and like kind of got a good country bass to him. So if you're looking for another country artist out there, recommend checking him out. Paul Cawthon again. And yeah, gotta say thanks to Dell for that.
Dell Barber, man.
That's cool.
Wicked.
And then, so I guess that brings us to what's on the grill.
What's on the grill this week, fellas?
Well, I haven't been grilling much myself, but I did smoke a few lake trout for my your buddy there, Chase, and I was quite happy with how they turned out. I think one of the keys there I noticed was to keep it like below a certain temp, mainly around that 170 range for as long as possible. And I think that really helped keep a lot of the moisture in that fish.
Nice, nice, yeah. I'm pretty happy about that deal too, because I got a jar of pickles and a jar of pickled beans out of it, and they were both fantastic, so thank you.
Holy. Not bad at all.
Yeah. Sheldon, what's on your grill this week, buddy?
Oh, man, I pulled out the old pit barrel, and I did a deer heart. My dad harvested a deer a few weeks ago, so I took the heart from that. I kind of did it a little bit different. Normally when I cook a deer heart, what I like to do is kind of bake it and in the oven. So this time I did it in the pit barrel. What I did is I just brushed on some like olive oil around, I don't know, 275, 300 degrees for a couple hours, pulled it out, and man, did it have a wicked taste to it. It was really, really smoky. And then I cleaned it up after, you know, like, I mean, it was clean, but I like took all the gristle and parts of the chambers and stuff apart, and like got all that kind of gristly, muscly stuff out of there.
Yeah.
After it was cooked, when normally I do it prior, like before. So anyways, I did that, and then I made like a Mexican bowl with brown rice and black beans and guac and, I don't know, green peppers, all stuff. And then cut this heart up, about half of it, sliced it really thin, and then cubed it after. So it was almost like really small bite-sized pieces. Threw it in this like little Mexican bowl. Yeah, and ate it like that. It was unreal. And then the next day, I just sliced the heart up, put a little bit of seasoning salt while it was cold, and threw it on a slice of cucumber and ate it as a snack. Unbelievable. So next time you're using your deer heart, there's a lot of ways to use it.
Nice.
I think I learned something there. Thanks, Sheldon.
I like that. I like that Mexican bowl idea. That sounds fantastic.
It was a game changer. It's, you know, it's one thing with whitetail, like we've all talked about growing up eating the steaks, eating this dried up steak, but finding ways to, you know, cook your whitetail up in different ways, I find very interesting now.
Yeah, nice, nice. That sounds, yeah, it's amazing. The grill on my front, well, I'm not going to go the wild route this week, but I did do up a mess of a meal for the in-laws this weekend. And on the old pit barrel, I fired that baby up, did a whole bunch of wings and some chicken breasts and jalapeno poppers on there. And hot damn, man, that is some good eats, let me tell you. I haven't had wings for a long time. Ooh. So we did up a bunch of wings.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah. And then I made up like a little sour cream, lime, cilantro dipping sauce for them. Just paired nice.
Yeah, so we definitely talk about, that sounds great. We definitely talk about the Pit Barrel a lot. I'm sure a lot of folks are aware that if you want one, check out pitbarrelcooker.com. They have all their selection there, as well as a ton of accessories. There's also a few places to get them in Canada, Lux Barbecue in Winnipeg being one of them. And I was even doing a little Google search, and I noticed that Canadian Tire might even carry some of them too. I didn't see any in Winnipeg, but I think a couple across Canada are starting to hop on the Pit Barrel train, as they should.
Nice.
So be sure to check them out. We love it, and I'm sure you would too.
They are certainly pretty sweet, man. We do a lot of cooking on those things, and they're yet to disappoint. Sheldon, are you there?
Yes, Chase.
How
may I help you?
What is your favorite tree stand snack these days?
Favorite tree stand snack, man. Beef jerky. Beef jerky's always been my favorite tree stand snack, and we finally got into some Cowboys caviar. Go to www.cowboyscaviar.com if you don't know what I'm talking about, or try to find it in your local convenience store. But this stuff is like chewable bite size, almost like a pepperette soft chew jerky. It's really good. They got 5 flavors, candy, or cowboy candy, they call it, original, teriyaki, hot and sweet and peppered. We've been eating it, munching it on the way to the tree stands. Like, Chase, you can't even get to the tree stand before it's gone. Tristan's eating it in the ground blind, and, yeah, and of course I'm chewing on it as well. So if you guys want to get into that jerky, look for it at your convenience store. You can go online, like I said, to their website. And not only that, they have a wicked fundraising system set up so that if you're looking to make some money for your whatever organization or group that needs to do some fundraising, check out their website, because what you can do is you can basically sign up with them, sell their jerky, and you can make up to 42% profit on all your sales. So it's something different than selling your almonds or your chocolate bars or whatever you may be doing. And it might be something that, you know, like I said, is different and people will attach to or cling on to. So check that out, www.cowboyscaviar.com.
You know how, like, when you buy a new car and you don't see like a new car that same model out there before, but as soon as you purchase that new vehicle, you see it everywhere?
Yes.
So like, since we've been eating Cowboy Caviar, like pretty much every store I go into now has it stocked in the shelf. So I know one gentleman said something about our post today on Instagram, I think, saying that he was having trouble finding it. And here in Manitoba, there's all sorts of grocers that carry it. So just keep your eyes peeled, folks. There's lots of it out there, and it's awesome. What's your favorite kind? What, since you guys have been eating?
Has to be pepper for me. I haven't had all of them. God help me once I do, but pepper has just been fantastic.
Sheldon?
I'd have to go with the candy. That's I like the teriyaki kind of type of beef jerky as well, but like I haven't tried this one in the teriyaki, but the candy is kind of like that sweetie type jerky. I guess it'd be closer to like a honey garlic just about, but yeah, I really enjoy the candy one.
Nice. Mine is the original, actually, out of all that. I think I've tried them all now. The original is just like, I don't know, it's the best, I think. Anyways, are we launching a podcast today?
Oh, man, can we get to it?
Episode 65. We got a pretty sweet guest on today. I don't know if anyone has watched Uncharted, Jim Shockey's Uncharted Yukon, but we have one of his main guides, Steve Pereira, on. And, man, we go down deep into the guide life as a moose hunting guide in the Yukon, and he gets into some good stories, tells some good tips, and just really talk about what it takes to be a guide up there. I really enjoyed this episode, and learned a bunch from him, and just sounds like an amazing adventure to be on.
Yeah, the cool thing about this episode that I really enjoyed, it's kind of, we went through kind of like a day in the life of a guide. There's a lot of things that he did say that really resonated with me. Just like the point of, you know, you got to basically suffer for how many days you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're away from your family and friends. And, yeah, it's a guide's life, you know, So it's a really cool episode. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's kind of one thing that I really kind of stuck with me too when I was watching the series is when Steve was heading out to go to Moose Camp and he's going for 3 weeks and he's saying goodbye to his son there and then everything's all good and then all of a sudden dad's actually leaving and his son's all broken up about it and it's sad. It's tough. It's a tough commitment. It's tough on the family and stuff. So it's interesting to see those aspects of that kind of life too, because everyone, lots of times all you see is like the success and stuff of the guide life. And it's Steve kind of takes you to the whole lifestyle experience, you know, from start to finish kind of thing. So,
yeah, man.
Anyways, without further ado, we'll fire this episode up. We hope you guys enjoy it.
Well, tonight we've got a great guest. I'm super excited to have him on. If you guys don't know Steve Pereira, and I had to ask him how to pronounce his last name because it's a little bit different, but on the TV show Uncharted with Jim Shockey, we've got one of his moose guides on tonight. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been, you know, one of the things we do talk about a lot on this podcast is the connectivity that we have in the hunting community. And it was basically one message and we started talking back and forth and got you on right away quick. And it's actually a perfect time for us because moose hunting season is just closing out in Manitoba. It just closed a few weeks ago, I guess. But how we're going to get this podcast started, I'm going to ask you 5 burning questions. And these questions can be are answered super quick. You can elaborate. You can do whatever you want. But the first question I have for you tonight, you're going moose hunting. What's the one gun that you're going to take with you, or the one weapon, if it might be a bow or whatever? What are you going to go to hunt your moose with?
Well, on the Yukon, we usually have higher calibers, usually 300s, 338s. You know, for Canada moose, smaller moose, I use a 7mm. But yeah, I'd say, you know, for the bigger game in up north, definitely like a 300, 338 in that caliber.
And to kind of double back on the question too, so you hunt or guide a majority of your moose in the Yukon, and what's the difference between size between a Yukon moose and say like a Southern Canada moose?
A Yukon moose can be, you know, live weight, 1,800 to 2,000 pounds. And the moose we get around home, maybe, you know, 1,000 pounds, 900, 1,000. Probably all four quarters hanging on the hook, you're looking at 550, 600 pounds, where a Yukon moose, you'd be pushing, you know, 900.
Oh, wow.
You know. Ooh. And we don't, when we bring our moose out, we don't bring the ribs. Usually we debone it so it gets in the plane. And it would be brutal packing out, you know, a front quarter with ribs and taking that to a full plane pilot. He'd be cursing at you. Yeah, he did that. So we debone everything. You know, we leave the ribs there and just pull the meat off all around the ribs and all around the neck and stuff, and just leave that whole spinal column and everything there and just take the meat.
That's a nice freezer full, man. I wish I had that right now.
I wish I had that problem right now. Yeah,
There's a lot. Those Yukon bulls are huge. Like, until you see one on the ground, they're massive.
I want to cut Sheldon off here from 5 burning questions for a second and kind of branch off of the firearms question. But do you have any particular projectile you prefer to send downrange at these things? We have these conversations quite a bit, and you see them a lot on like the social platforms on what's the best bullet to use. And lots of guys like the partitions and these bullets that are just dumping their entire energy in this animal. But I'm a big proponent of using like a full copper bullet that's like a Barnes TSX kind of thing that I know is going to punch through that animal and just really focus on shot placement. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say 100% is shot placement. If you can get anywhere into the, you know, behind the shoulder, into the lung cavity, the heart, you know, it's that moose is done. You know, for the animal size wise, you know, they're tough. These things are tough, but you know, at the end of the day, their lungs are massive too. So if you puncture the lung or double lung them, they're not going to go far, right? So it's, you know, it's shot placement. You know, bullets, you can use, You can use a Barnes, you can use a Burger, you can use a Federal, Trophy Bonded Tip. They're all going to do the same job. They're going to just punch through the fur and just get into the, you know, into the lung cavity there, or any of the organs, you know, heart, you know, liver, whatever. You'll finish the moose off.
It's yeah. Like, so you're not married or really talking up any other bullet brand. You're just saying make the right shot, and that's what we're going to focus on.
Absolutely. Like, you know, I don't generally, I like to take a nice broadside shot and go behind the shoulder. I don't like the punch through the shoulder. You know, some guys will say punch through the shoulder, and then you're wasting that meat. You know, there's no need to. You can just go right through, you know, behind the shoulder, and it's not going to go far. So, and you save the meat. And, you know, we bring the meat home. We donate the meat to the local First Nations up there too. So we want to make sure that we try to, you know, do the best ethical shot. And for me, you know, guiding, the biggest shot is behind the shoulder. Like, it's a massive area, and you can't go wrong, you know, taking that shot. You're gonna you know, take an ethical shot, and then the animal's gonna not go very far.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm just looking at a 32-inch TV sitting on top of Tristan's bar here, and I'm thinking that's about the same size as probably about a moose's lungs. Maybe it's a little bit smaller, but it's a pretty good target to toss some lead at. So I totally agree with what you're saying there.
So yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We're going to jump on to question number two for the five burning questions. You've got one last concert to go to, live or dead. Who would you go and watch?
Metallica, all the way, man.
Metallica. Nice. We had another guest on that said Metallica as well. I can't remember who it was off the top of my head. Question number three, you have one last meal. What are you going to have? You can put some detail into it, and I'll put a drink on the side of it.
I would say, you know, steak and crab with a beer.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Are you doing like beef steak, moose steak? Is there anything you?
No, absolutely. 100% moose steak. I can't, you know, once you have, you know, moose, it's hard to go back to beef. Right. So yeah. Even the best cut is, you know, is the back strap, you know, tenderloin. But we do eat a lot of times when we get our animals, we'll do fresh back strap right there in the bush, you know, and all the clients get to eat it. And we'll do onions, we'll do mushrooms. It's like, you just can't go wrong with that. It's the best. Yeah. Just love it.
Yeah, for sure. My next question actually is kind of tied into this one. You said, for your drink of choice was an ice cold beer, but what kind of beer would that be? Like, and not only that, like, do you guys have a celebration harvest drink? Like, I know in our camps we have some traditions where it might be, you know, a Mickey of Sourpuss. We might have a Mickey of Sourpuss when we shoot a moose or whatever it may be. But do you guys have that drink of choice after you harvest the moose?
At home we do, but when we're in the Yukon, we usually run a dry camp. We don't have alcohol in our camps, just because you want to make sure everybody's 100%, you know, like, right. that there's a lot of money on the line with the guided hunt. So if the client chooses to bring a drink or bring a bottle and share with us after, for a celebration, then absolutely we'll partake. But we don't generally bring alcohol into camp. But at home, absolutely. We get a moose down. We whiskey and Cokes all night celebrating, right?
Nice. Trophy night. That's what we call it out here.
And beer choice for me is Budweiser. I'm a Bud guy.
Bud heavy.
King of beers. That's my the one guy I had permission to archery elk hunt his land this year. That was his go-to too. Said there is no other beer.
Yeah.
And my last question, I guess, for the five burning questions, and part of the podcast, I guess, is to figure out who you are, what you do. But if you could visit anywhere in this world, where would you go?
My number one animal on my bucket list is to go to Kyrgyzstan for ibex, for mid-Asian ibex. That's my bucket list. Ooh. And I'm hoping to fulfill that in the next 2 years. We're talking with Asian Mountain Outfitters. So we're seeing if we can put that together in the next couple of years.
Damn, man, that's a hard hunt.
Yeah, with that Brian Martin. No, I sheep hunt and I mountain goat hunt, and so I've put my time in the mountains, and that's my my bucket list for sure, is to go get one of those animals. And I've been talking with Brian Martin there, and he's told me that the lowdown, like all this, everything you need to know. So that's what I want to do in the next, like I said, in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of preparation that goes into that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's high elevation. It's cold, and the biggest thing is you're in a third world country, so language and culture and everything's a little bit different than here in North America.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'd like to congratulate you for getting through the five burning questions, and now it's on to the meat and potatoes of the podcast. And the first thing we're going to ask you, and it's kind of very generic, so please elaborate as much as you want, but how did you cut your teeth in the world of getting into the guiding business, especially when it comes to the north part of the world in the Yukon, where it's, you know, you might not see anyone forever? How did that all happen? How did it start? And yeah, just tell us how that went.
Well, by trade, I was a videographer, so I've moved into management. So I worked for a company called Bell Media, which owns multiple companies in Canada here, CTV being one of them. So I was a shooter, editor, and being a hunter, you know, I would videotape my own hunts and stuff. And we did a flying hunt out of Dease Lake, and Dease Lake is up near the Yukon border in northern British Columbia. And coming out of the bush, we're at the gas station. There's only one gas station in Dease Lake, and I was fueling my truck up, heading home, and then Jim Shockey was fueling his truck up right beside us. So I was, went up to him, started talking, because, you know, this is back in 2005, right? So his hunting show just was kind of a couple years into it, but I recognized him from all the magazines and stuff. So we struck a conversation up, talked, and I told him I was a cameraman. He said, hey, shoot me an email. We're always looking for guys. And I didn't do anything for a year and a bit, and then I just remember that conversation. So I did shoot him an email, and I got a response back. And next thing you know, he was like, let's go on a sheep hunt, and I want you to be my cameraman / backpack Sherpa / guide. And that was in 2008. Yeah, we flew into the remote part of the Yukon on a backpack sheep hunt with the man Jim Shockey. That was kind of like my initiation to the club, if I was gonna pass or fail. So we didn't get any animals on that trip. We were, you know, going for stone sheep, but we got stuck in a tent for 3 days in a snowstorm, and I got to know him pretty well. And and then from there, I came back 3 weeks later to videotape some hunts in the Yukon / assistant guide. And that was my introduction. That's kind of how I got into it.
Man, Jim set the bar high there for you, tossing you right into the stone sheep out of the gate.
Yeah, no. I mean, funny thing is my backpack, I'm like 135, 140 pounds, and my backpack was like way heavier than his backpack.
I believe it. So at that point, had you done quite a few sheep hunts and like built up your resume a little bit, just at like a personal level?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. At that point, I think I had two stone sheeps under my belt. My friend had one, had a California bighorn under my belt, multiple mountain goats, you know, locally here. So yeah, the mountains and, you know, conditioning your body and mentally, you know, it's not, you know, to be a mountain hunter is not easy. You need to have, you know, back then I didn't have the gear that we have today. Like everything is so lightweight, carbon fiber. You can cut so many pounds off just with this new technology, new gear that's out there. But, you know, back then it was just, you know, conditioning your body and having the mental will to, you know, to climb the next mountain and just keep going. So, I wasn't foreign to it. And, you know, I impressed the boss enough that I continued on in the organization.
That's awesome. That's one thing, man, I always think about when I see those nice, picturesque, just beautiful photos of like either the mountains or the backcountry or whatever it may be, and guys like taking photos out of their tent doors or their tent setup and stuff like that. A lot of times I try and put myself in their shoes, and I think, I mean, some of the selling point for that for a lot of people is just like, oh man, look how nice that is. That must be amazing to be there. And you spoke about it a few seconds ago there, just the mental toughness. And I think what people don't realize is how
tough you have to be to do those backpack hunts and get into the backcountry and wake up every day freezing cold and put your wet boots on or put your wet gear on if it's raining, you know, and just break through that first hour of the day pretty much.
Yeah, you got, it's definitely it with now with all the rain gear and lightweight rain gear and stuff that's out there, it's, you know, you can hunt in the rain. But when I was hunting, as soon as it started raining, you know, especially if it started coming down pretty hard or snowing hard, you would just throw your tent up right away, get out of the weather.
Yeah.
And but yeah, at least you would stay semi-dry and you can be warm. And because you don't want to get hypothermia. If you get hypothermia, you're done. You're out of there.
Yeah.
So you just get in your tent, get in your sleeping bag and just weather the storm. And if it's a drizzle, you can use your rain gear and you know, and even the light rain. But if it starts coming down, you got to get into some sort of shelter, because a lot of these places it's barren. There's no firewood. There's no way to, you know, even get a fire going to warm yourself up and dry your gear off. You got to get back down into the timber to do that, and then you're kind of counterproductive because you're going down instead of staying upright. So you just do the best you can to keep dry and warm, and then when it breaks, you can get out and start covering ground again and glassing and looking for those animals.
Right on. And so you kind of cut your teeth. That's how you found your way with Jim Shockey and doing the moose guiding thing. What year did you start your own kind of, I wouldn't say your own, but like your guiding camp, and like when you started branching out and taking on your own clients?
Well, actually it was that year. So I did that sheep hunt with Jim in 2008, videotaped it. So he knew I was capable and I was a hunter and I knew how to hunt and I knew how to run a camera. But I came back. So that was in August, came back for the September. So I think I went home for like a week and a half, came back. The very first hunt I did, I was doing a camera hunt, just videotaping, but like assistant guide. So there was a father-son team. And the very first moose I saw, and on paper, it was my client on paper, but technically I was videotaping it and I had a guide license and everything. The very first moose I laid eyes on in the Yukon that the dad got was like 67 and a half.
Oh, wow.
So the bar was set like right up the gate, super high.
No kidding, eh?
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So I thought all these moose in the Yukon are this big, right? Because it just like, hey, the first one I saw is 67 and a half. So they got to be all the size, right? So after we got that one, that was the first one, and the son got one about 57 inches. And then I was supposed to stay in that camp and videotape a second hunt, but then Jim called the main boss, who back then was Fred Lackey, and he said, hey, I want Steve to go to a different camp. He's going to guide, and he's going to videotape, so he's going to go solo. And I was like, what? I just started, man.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I went to another camp, which was on a lake, and I had to open it up, and I was by myself. Well, they had to fly in a rifle for me because I didn't even have a rifle, because I was just supposed to be videotaping / assistant guiding, right? So, yeah, the client came in, and that was my first solo guided hunt / video. I videotaped the whole thing, too, and, yeah, the client got about a 57-inch moose on, I think it was day five, and that's pretty much when I cut my teeth into guiding by myself. But then after that, you know, every year would vary. I'd come in and be an assistant guide or guide with another guide and then I started guiding solo 100% by myself in 2013. But all those other years, a lot of times you'll have like two people hunting together. So you always need two guides together. So you're a guide, but you're sharing camp with another guide, and it's like it's either a father son or two buddies hunting together. So you're not by yourself, you're together, but right. you're still guiding. You know, so I stopped kind of videotaping the hunts around 2013, 2014. I got my first cameraman that would start following me around for that whole Uncharted series pilot.
So that brings up another question for me, just at the top of my head, and before we like carry on to the kind of the framework of the podcast. But when you're, now that you have some background in the camera work side of things, and then now that you're guiding without the camera, are you kind of giving the guy shit and being like, no, no, you got to be over here. No, no, you got to be over here. Like, do you find yourself kind of still, you know, drumming back into the camera work side of things?
No, not really. Most of those guys, like most of my cameramen are professionals. They're amazing videographers and photographers. Like, they'll get amazing pictures. I've never, ever had to, you know, get involved and tell them what to do. It's more on the, you know, the safety aspect. If they were doing something that was, you know, like, hey guys, you can't do this. You got to be safe. Like, we're in the middle of nowhere, right. You know? So it's just that kind of stuff. But yeah, they're amazing. All the guys I've worked with are professionals. So they actually, you know, like the stuff they can do nowadays, I don't even want to get back into it because it's like they're just in a different realm than what I was used to, right?
Oh yeah, and it's funny because we had a couple months ago we had Cody Robbins' cameraman Rich Caseman on our podcast, and he was kind of elaborating on some of those shots, and you know, when you gotta basically say like, we don't have the shot, like let's just wait and stuff like that. So we kind of dove into that when it comes to camera work, and it's quite interesting on what it takes to actually make a show. But for this podcast, we kind of want to talk about what it takes to be a guide, in moose country, not only in the Yukon or maybe anywhere else in the world. But let's start out. What time does your day start when it comes to moose hunting? What time are you guys getting up out of bed and what's your next step?
Yeah, generally when the client, you're pretty much kind of just on camping trip vacation before the client gets there. You know, you can sleep in, but you have camp to set up. Usually we'll do camp set up 2-3 days. In my camp, we had 2 Arctic ovens and a wall tent. We had a pretty big camp. We were running a, you know, six man camp. And we had propane heaters in each Arctic oven, but in the wall tent, we had a wood stove. So there's a lot of prep to get everything set up. And we're running 2 jet boats with Yamaha 30 horse jet motors. So you got, like I said, you got a lot of prep. But as soon as a client gets in, you're up at 5 a.m., 5:30 a.m.-ish, making sure, you know, that the tents are, you know, if you, you know, the wall tents, you got firewood going, you got breakfast going, got coffee going. And, you know, they get up. Usually we have like a light breakfast, coffee. And then I want to be out on the river, you know, like first light. Right. And we're either running up river or we're drifting down river and calling. So that's generally, you know, peak is, you know, first, especially with the rut, it's unpredictable. A lot of times we get the majority of our moose mid-afternoon. You can't predict what's going to happen, right? But you got to, you know, these clients are paying customers. You got to be up first thing in the morning and out the door hunting. You know, you can't be, you know, heading out at 9 a.m. It just, it looks bad. And, you know, like I said, if I spent, you know, $25,000 US, I'd want to be out, you know, first light.
Yeah,
as well. Sure. So you got to think about, put yourself in their shoes. Like, you know, if I was this guy, what would I do, right? So, but then the day goes till, you know, last light. In the Yukon, it's getting dark around 9 p.m. So we pull in pretty much when it's dark, and then we're eating dinner. We're cooking dinner, eating dinner. So you get to bed some nights midnight. So you're talking, you know, like 19-hour days. So
yeah,
it's the one thing I'll say is, if you want to be a guide, you got to love what you're doing. You got to love the outdoors. You got to have passion for it, because it's long days. It pays okay. You're not going to be rich off of it. You got to have the passion. You got to love it. And number one, you got to be a people person. If you're not a people person, don't even get into it, because you got to be able to talk to people. You got to be able to have conversations. And if you can't do that, then, you know, it's going to be awkward, right? Like, you're spending, you know, all this time with a person. You got to be able to, you know, carry conversations and know when to talk and know when not to talk, and know what to say and know what not to say. Because the last thing you want to do is piss your client off, and next thing you know, he's flying out because he said something to offend him, right? So you just got to, it takes time. You got to just read the line and read your client And but you know, like I said, it is rewarding. It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's a lot of work too. You got to have the passion. You got to love the outdoors. But above the outdoors, you got to love, you know, doing what you do and customer service, because at the end of the day, that's what this is. It's customer service.
Are you, so you're spending all day on the boat floating the river there?
Well, we'll float down. Most of the time we'll make a decision. We float down the river one day, call, see what we get, get some action. And then we'll, you know, do that till about noon, head up river, get to camp, have a quick, you know, breakfast, you know, whatever. And then, either if we had some action downriver, we'll go back down, or we'll go upriver and we'll just alternate. You know, I usually like to float downriver in the morning, because if you have boat problems, you can get it resolved and come back up. I wouldn't want to be floating downriver in the evening and then have your boat break down and then you're stuck downriver. But we always prepare for that just in case. We always have a pop-up tent. We have extra fuel, so we could always pull up on the beach and, you know, we've done it before. We've had a little spike camp on the side of the beach.
That makes sense.
We prepare. Just, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So, yeah, but you are, you're not in the boat the whole time. I'll hit beaches, back channels, islands, walk around, look for sign, you know, call, rake. That way you're getting out and stretching your legs too. And, you know, you look for sign. And, you know, the one year we found a lot of tracks on this one beach, and a lot of broken, you know, branches from the bull raking. So we knew we had a bull in the area, and you could see kind of, it wasn't full like scrapes, but it was like you could see the start of it. And we ended up getting that bull, I think it was 2 days after that. So he was in that area. He wasn't in full rut, but he was starting to stake his ground, you know, like he was making his rounds, starting to lightly scrape his the branches and willows and stuff. So getting out of the boat and walking and looking at kind of what you can't see from the boat always pays off, and it helps you kind of locate where they're hanging out, and that's key, and then you can focus on that area.
Yeah, that's cool. Stevie, I'm just going to circle back to starting out camp. You said that there was, you have a couple Arctic ovens and then like a wall tent. Can you kind of paint us a picture on like, what does your camp look like? Like, do you have both Arctic ovens are for sleeping quarters, and then your wall tent's like a kind of cooking, eating area, or like, how does that look?
Yeah, the one Arctic oven's for guide / cameraman. So usually we'll have 2, 3, or 4 people in there. And then the cookhouse is pretty much the wall tent. It's empty. It's like an office. You know, the video guys will go in there and they'll charge your batteries. We've got a generator running pretty much 24/7, a Honda generator, and just charging batteries. And then we'll cook in there. We'll eat in there. We'll socialize in there and you know, whatever. And then the other Arctic ovens where the clients will sleep. So like I said, both Arctic ovens have propane heaters, so they're regulated by thermostats. So we just make sure we turn the bottles off before we head out hunting, so we don't burn our propane, because you know, those they don't burn a lot, but you go through propane if you just leave it for the whole day, right? So
yeah,
just turn the bottle off.
Costs a lot of money to fly that stuff in.
It, absolutely. Yeah. It does, especially when you're in the middle of nowhere, right? So the clients, they have their space and they sleep in their space. We have our space. We all have cots. And then the wall tents, like the hangout, you know, cooking, socializing, office area for, you know, video guys. And then the beach, we have the two boats. And we have lots of, 45 gallon drums full of fuel that we, go through that season running up river. Cause we're generally running the river probably 20 days after a client's arrival, or 20 days pretty much nonstop until, you know, when we get an animal, we'll slow down, take a break. But some years you push it right to the last day. So, you do go through fuel, because like I said, there's, you know, 8 full days of hunting, one day when the clients fly in, and if they get in early enough, after we wait 6 hours, which is the Yukon law after flying, then we'll go out for an evening hunt. And then their fly out day, we generally don't hunt. Let's hang around camp, and unless one walks across camp, we would think about it.
Yeah. So we got your camp kind of figured out. You also mentioned that you guys have a light breakfast before you take off for the day. Do you guys pack lunches or do you guys usually hit camp again before you start going back up river or back down river or whatever you guys may do that day? Like, how does that work out?
We always pack lunches. We always have a Tupperware full of snacks, fruit, chocolate bars, cookies, a ham, you know, bread, mustard, mayo. So we can stop and have, you know, lunch or a snack at any time. But yeah, if we do float down river, then we would come up, have a breakfast, and then we'd either go up river or go back down river. But if we go up river, we're gone for the day. Like, you know, right. I would run probably, you know, an hour and 15 minutes up river, and we just slowly work our way down and get back to camp in the dark, right? So, but we always have extra food in a Tupperware, you know, just in case we end up getting one and we end up spending the night, we have some food to eat, right? So you just always prepare for, you always got to think, hey, if we end up spending the night, do I have everything to, you know, we're not going to have sleeping bags, but, you know, we got, you know, like a chainsaw so we can make a fire. We got extra gas. If it's pouring rain and we need a fire, we got gas we can use to get a fire going. We got matches. We got food. I always bring tarps just in case. And, just to make it not uncomfortable, if that makes sense. It's going to be uncomfortable, but make it a little bit more comfortable than uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, like, that's the thing, too, is Chase and I both have done lots of moose hunting up here in northern Manitoba, and usually we're kind of a boat ride away from the camp as well. But we don't – I'm just going to say, speak for myself, I don't necessarily prepare myself to be overnight somewhere just for the fact that we're not in the middle of the Yukon, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, we might be secluded and we have a few guys around, but, you know, just preparing for where you guys are hunting is probably day and night from moose hunting situations that we're in. So you guys are all prepared for the day. You guys pack your lunches. You guys are going up river, down river, whatever it may be. Now it's lunchtime. You guys have your snack. What's your next plan of attack? Like, in my mind, you know, like a lot of people say, or you've said earlier that, you know, you shot a lot of moose in the afternoon, but in my mind, you know, the moose start moving closer to the nighttime. But what's your afternoon plan? Like, are you kind of sitting still and calling, or are you still moving around quite a bit? What's your strategy there?
Yeah, no, generally we'll hit a location where we can, you know, spend a couple hours. Like, so if we go up river, we'll hit a spot. We'll just park the boat. And depending, you know, we're looking for where we've seen sign. If we spotted the cow in the area or something. And we'll just, yep, spend, you know, 2-3 hours there calling and raking. And then, you know, slowly work our way down or work our way back up. But, it's, you know, with the rut, it's so unpredictable. Like, you know, it could be morning, it could be evening, or it could be, you know, noon or 2 o'clock. Like, you just but sitting at camp, you know, having a siesta, you're not going to get a moose. So we got to get out and, you know, make sure that, you know, the client can have a siesta on the beach. That's fine by me as long as I'm focused and looking, because a lot of times, like I said, they're right there. It's just, they're just not moving, right? And then it just, something perks their attention and now they're out. So you got to be out there so that you can see that and, you know, catch them on the move. And because that's a lot of times it's just catching them moving, right? You know, a lot of times they do come to your call and they'll maybe answer if you're raking with a paddle, but a lot of times it's just they're going to move and you caught them moving. So now it's go time, right?
Yeah. I think that goes to speak for a lot of hunting practices too. And you hear a lot of guys saying, you know, just being out there is one of the best tactics to employ to be successful. And again, that rut time of year is just very unpredictable. And I know we kill in the rut, like lots of our whitetails in the big bush are killed from like 10 and 2 o'clock during the day. So it really goes kind of against the morning sit and the evening sit kind of thing. And you just never know.
I've had all three. I've had first light, last light, and right from camp at 2 o'clock.
Nice.
Like, it's just, you can't predict it. It's going to happen when it happens, right?
Yeah. There's obviously just tons of great moose habitat up there, to be able to like produce these beautiful poles. But, is there areas along the river, say like, some of the camps that you return to where you go up and you're like, we're going to kill a moose here this year again, kind of thing.
Yeah. So yeah, it's sometimes, and sometimes you say you're going to kill a moose this year and it's the total opposite, you know, it's just, you just can't really, it's yeah. A few times we did nail it. And, it's now that I've been at that river, I was there 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 in the same camp. We've pretty much got it figured out now that majority of the bulls we get are downriver. You know, you might fluke out and get a couple upriver, but majority consistently, because I usually mark on a map all our kills, and consistently right around this 300 yard range, it's consistently, there's an old burn there and they cross there back and forth. So that's the hot spot, right?
Oh yeah. Just prime feed and prime habitat for them. And just that's able to hold just, a really good population of, and support a good population of moose.
Yeah. Yeah. And there've been some really big ones that have come out of that area too. So, but some years we didn't see the big ones. We saw, you know, like mid 50s, you know, up to, you know, high 50s, you know, 60s, but, you know, the big ones, you know, like, you know, the mid 60s, 65, 68, you know, some years we see them, some years we get them, some years we don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see, you know, like I said, you know, the mid 50s, and it's just, it depends on what's going on that year with, you know, weather and other things and high water and low water and stuff, because that all impacts hunting, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of water conditions and stuff, especially in a riverboat. And if you get a hard freeze in the middle of September, and then all your swamps are frozen and your back channel's frozen solid, and you just have the main river, that definitely impacts what these moose are doing. You know, like, they might be now moving up to higher ground. They're not going to be down in the lower area. So that all, you know, takes into account, you know, what you see, because you can only see so much when you're on a river. You can see the banks, and you can try to climb up a high hill and look down into some swamps, or in some back channels and stuff, but it's pretty heavily forested, and the burn area you can see a bit in there, but it's still pretty thick. So it's not like when you watch our shows and you watch Jim up in the high country and he's spotting out of his Argo and you see all those willows. We don't have that in the low country. It's pretty thick, heavily forested area. So you're pretty much relying on a moose stepping out to your call or walking on the beach, and you're seeing him that way.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of stock up there.
Slip away and get into some cover and hide pretty, disappear pretty quick.
Yeah.
What's, so you're just talking about the size of the moose. And you said like the mid 60s, probably up to 70s is like the high range of that. And what is the average? So you're talking about mid 50s kind of thing, but would that be like the average bull you guys kind of see around there?
Well, we like to take, you know, in the 60 range. That's kind of our average, is in the 60s, you know, and that might be, you know, like, 59, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62. Around there, that's our average. We pride ourselves on, you know, like mature animals, like, you know, it's the 60 inch animal is kind of where we want to be. But, you know, I'll tell my clients, you know, you might get a 60, that's one measurement, that's from this point to this point, that's your widest point. But you might have a 55 that is like a beautiful, you know, full paddles, picket fence, 5x5 fronts, like just phenomenal. But he's going to score better than that 60 because he's got more stuff, and he's going to be a prettier bull. So, but a lot of guys get hung up on, oh, it's got to be 60. Well, no, this 55 is way better than that 60. But a lot of guys will pass on that because they're just stuck on, it's got to be a 60. And it's like, well, I would rather shoot that 55.
Yeah.
Than just take a 60 that's, you know, got maybe two or three fronts, and he's you know, he's just got one measurement. He's got just from the widest point to the widest point, 60 inches. But, you know, it's up to the, at the end of the day, it's up to the client, you know, what they want. But it's, you know, like I said, you can get some really beautiful, nice 55 inches that are phenomenal and that you wouldn't want to pass. So it's, you know, it's up to the client at the end of the day, right? What they're looking for, what they want to take.
Yeah, for sure. And Steve, I'm going to have to ask you this question. I haven't seen that many big bulls when it comes to over, say, 50 inches. I think the biggest bull I've ever seen is in Churchill, Manitoba. It was like 50 to 55. Never got to measure them because I never shot them, but just seen them. But how do you judge that? Like, what are the kind, like, some of the major features when you know it's above 55 inches, let's say, or it's getting into that 60 inch mark? Like, how do you know that, especially when you're at a distance looking at them?
If he's got two sheets of plywood, you're pretty good to go.
Yeah.
Sure. What I look at generally is, you know, and if an older bull, it could really kind of bite you in the ass, but you look at the ears, right? Their ears, once they drop their ears down, you kind of have to visualize it. But if their ears are in their pans, then he's going to be around, you know, mid 50s. Like if the tip of the ears are kind of like, you know, a third of the way into the pan, you're looking at, he's going to be mid 50s. If the tips of the ears are right at the edge of the pan and it's just touching, you're going to be at that 60, 62. And if there's a clear gap, clear space between the tip of the ear and the start of the pan, then you're going to be in the mid 60s. And it's just looking at the ears. And like I said, I thought moose were bigger just by looking at the ears, but you know, the ears were either smaller or just not what I thought that year. And the moose was a little bit smaller, but we're talking game of inches here too, right? Like,
right.
You know, you could say it's 62 and it's actually 57, 58. Well, that's only 2 inches, 2.5 inches on each side. Right. But, that's what I look at. And now you look at, you know, the pans, how tall the pans are. And if they turn broadside and you can see where the pans go, if they go up close to the hump, top of the shoulders, then you know you got a long pan, right?
Right.
So it's just experience and just looking at animals, and you just kind of gauge, you know, how wide they are by just doing a lot of, you know, looking at a lot of big animals, a lot of big moose, right?
Right.
No, I've been pretty fortunate that the judging has been fairly close. I haven't had any big blunders, so still got a job, so that's good.
Right on. And so we're still kind of talking about the day of life of a guide. Those days when you're up and down the rivers and you're not seeing nothing, are there certain things that you're trying to keep your client like keened in on? Like, is there sign? Is there things you're looking for? Are there, like you said, you went, you know, you'll get out of the boat and stretch your legs and go for a walk. Like, there's got to be something that you're looking for doing those things. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, well, the main thing is keeping your client motivated. The minute negativity sets in, you're done. Like, you can't fix it. It's so you got to make sure you're always positive. You keep them upbeat. With moose hunting, it's literally a light switch flicks and it's on. Like, when the rut kicks in, you got little bulls coming, medium bulls coming, and then finally get your big bull. So, but sometimes the only bull you might see is your shooter bull. Like, you don't see anything else. You don't get to play with any small bulls. But you know, if you get, hopefully before that, you actually get to see some smaller bulls and you can play with them and get them coming in. And that gets the client excited. He gets that experience with them grunting and coming in, even though that they're small. Right. But it's the main thing is just always being out there, always, you know, just keep reassuring the client that, hey, it can happen any second. You know, that's why we do 8-day hunts. You might have nothing for 7 days, and bang, day eight is you get your moose, right? Well, the only thing we got to see is one bull. We got to see one bull that's big enough. That's it. So that's pretty much what I like to do, is just, you got to stay positive. You got to, like I said, keep the client motivated and keep their spirits high and keep telling them stories and reassuring them that, you know, if you do like recaps, and, like last year, this is what happened. And the year before that, we got one here. And, you know, the year before that, we got one here. We got one this, you know, that way it kind of keeps them like, you know, excited that it could happen at any time. Right. So that's the main thing, is just keeping everybody, not just like the client. You know, you got a cameraman and you might have an observer. So keeping everybody's motivation, you know, levels going, and you try to just stay away from negativity. The minute negativity sets in, it's a deal breaker. You're done.
Yeah, and I'd have to agree with that. Like, we've got a moose camp that we've got fairly well established, where we've been there, and you know, like, we'll be sitting there and we'll talk about the old times and about, oh, Uncle Jack or Uncle Norman shot one here and shot one there, and we like amuse ourselves and keep ourselves busy and keep the hopes up high that we're actually going to see one. And at the same time, we've been going to that moose camp for years now, and at times not seen one for 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 or 8, 12 days, you know what I mean? So I can totally agree with and know exactly what you're saying when it comes to keeping the hopes high, because at the same time, like, you know, you might be just walking down the trail or doing whatever you're doing, and then all of a sudden there's a bull moose standing there looking at you. The other question I have to kind of relate to this, you know, the downtimes of guiding moose, you know, you haven't seen a moose for a little while, and maybe a subpar or smaller moose does show itself. What is that like for you and the client, and what goes down there? Like, is it to the point where you're like, well, you know, we're not seeing much, maybe we should take this, or is there some sort of, you know, like, what are you doing, I guess, when you see a smaller moose?
I well, small being 50 inches is what I wouldn't even personally, by, you know, the animals I've seen in the Yukon, I would never, you know, tell my client to shoot a 50 incher unless he was adamant he was going to shoot 50 inches because he didn't want to go home, and that was his decision. Because at the end of the day, that it's their decision, it's their money, it's their hunt. If they're dead set on shooting a 50 inch moose, you can't stop them. Like, right. That's their hunt. You have to let them do it. You know, you can kind of say, hey, well, I think we can get a bigger one, but if they're adamant, that's their money, that's their hunt, that's their decision. So you gotta respect that and say, okay, no problem. And you have to, obviously, you know, be happy. You can't be like, oh man, it sucks. But you know, I generally would tell them, depending where in the hunt it was, it's day 3, day 4, day 5, I would pass 50s, just because I know what's there. I you know, the animals that are there, and you know, it's, you're rolling the dice. You are definitely rolling the dice. But a lot of the hunters that I have would rather come back and spend the money, if they're able to get what they want. Like, you know, they want a trophy animal. They're not there for a meat hunt. They're there for a trophy animal. So most of these people have the financial means that they can come back. So they would pass on the 50. But, you know, some other guides have had clients that are, yeah, they're going to take a 50 and you can't talk me out of it. And you know, we're, like I said, we're customer service. So you gotta respect that and help them achieve that dream that they came for, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be tough if you had me and Chase in the camp there and a couple cases of beer. We'd probably be shooting 50 inches for sure.
Meatball.
No. Fill the freezer.
Well, here's the story. It's like I said, you roll the dice, right? So if you watch the Uncharted Yukon show, Sarah and Shad were the clients there, and I think it was episode 7 or 8, and she turned down a 55 inch moose, right? So then I get the gears, because it looked like on TV I turned it down, but I told the client it was her decision, your decision, and she said, no, we don't want to kill it, right? We're here for something big. So we didn't, that was on day 2, it was mid 50s, we didn't see another animal for 7 days. So they ended up pulling her and moving her to a different camp, and she ended up getting a 66.
That was with was that with Roddy, or who?
I know Brian Argan.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, Brian Argan, they moved him to their camp. So it worked out. And at the end of the day, it was, you know, my pride set aside because, yeah, it sucked for me. But at the end of the day, it's for the client is number one. So, yeah, my pride got hurt because I didn't get my animal from my client and they pulled her out of my camp. But she got the animal she paid $25,000 US for. She got the moose she wanted. A 55-inch moose was not what she wanted. Right. And we knew that from the very beginning. So we made that call. And, you know, on television, it looks like I failed. But, you know, it was the right decision for the client. And they were very happy that they made that decision. And she said, I'll come back a third time if I have to get the animal I want. Because they have the means to do that with their financial well-being, right? Like, they can do that. Other hunters can't. If they saved and saved and saved and saved their whole entire life, and this is their one-shot deal, they can't come back, then yeah, you're going to take that 55-incher because I know you can't come back. So, you know, it's a gamble. And if they're happy with that 55, then, you know, let's do it. But again, like, it's tough. Like, you want to push them to shoot it, but you don't want to push them to shoot it that they're mad that they shot a small moose. You want to, if it's a good representative of the Yukon, you want to edge them. Like, I would take that moose. You know, I would pass that moose. And that might be like, okay, well, I'll do it then. Or, you know, I would rather wait. Well, then, like I said, you roll the dice on that and it could work for you or it couldn't, right?
Right. Man, it's so funny listening to you talk about moose hunting and just to hear the differences that you deal with up in the Yukon compared to here in Manitoba. But some of the similarities that, like, I've experienced, whether it's moose hunting or moose guiding, is, like, we in Manitoba, like, there's obviously some good trophy moose here once in a while. They're not like the Yukon. So when I guided for moose, I just have a funny story here about one of my clients we were dealing with. You know, we kind of promoted, like, just if you see a bull, you should think about taking it unless you want a trophy. But it might be the last bull that you see for the trip. So you really get those, what we call the highs and lows of moose hunting. You know, there's no action, no action, no action. And we had this one client in camp, and he was an older fella, and he had been complaining about how he went into Ontario to hunt moose, and they didn't see anything, and it looks exactly like this. And we didn't see anything for probably 5 or 6 days. And he was just like, he had it. He had enough. And like you said, that negativity comes into camp, and it's just like trying to swim upstream, trying to bring that guy back. But like day six rolls around and he nails a moose on the river and he's already booking for next season.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happens. I had in 2014, it was before we had the Uncharted Yukon show. It was our pilot season. So the show was actually, you can actually watch it. It's on my outdoor TV. It's called The Outfit. Might be Jim Shock. He's The Outfit, or just The Outfit, like, you know, The Outfitter, but it's called The Outfit. And I had a client, his name was Chance Cornett out of Texas. So we, same thing, we hit it hard. We saw one tiny little bull, a cow, a small grizzly bear, and two wolves that the one he shot missed and the one he shot and wounded. And that's what we saw in 9 days. Like that, we saw two moose. And so we got back to camp. This was on the very last day of the hunt. Tomorrow he's flying out. And it's like, so we floated down. We did the whole, you know, get up in the morning, have breakfast, or not have breakfast, have a light breakfast, get out, float down river, spend all morning down there. We get back to, you know, camp up river around 12:30. And he tells me he's done. He's finished. You know, like, it was a great hunt. He had a great time. But, he knows that, you know, the moose aren't moving. We got a full moon. You know, they're nocturnal and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But I did a great job. He had a great time. And I'm like, you're quitting? You can't quit, man. Like, we have an evening hunt here. We're going to jump here into camp, have a quick bite to eat. We're in that boat. We're going up river. He's like, no, we're done. We're done. I had a great time. And I'm like, just completely, like, you know, when the client quits on you, like, you're like, you went from like, well, it wasn't a lot of action, but now you're rock bottom now. So I nothing I could do to talk, you know, Chance into, you know, to getting into the boat. He had one of those Blauser guns, and he was already cleaning it, and he was taking the barrel apart. So his gun was in pieces. And my cameraman was Brett Taylor, and he's like, "What are we gonna do?" And I'm like, "Hang out here. I'm just gonna call from camp because he's done." So Brett was, you know, taking his camera apart, and I just started calling right from the, you know, I was actually at the outhouse doing a little business there, and calling, and Chance is sitting on the beach laughing at me because he's like, "You're not gonna call a moose. You know, we've been doing it for 8 days up and down the river. Good luck." Anyways, to make a long story short, I called for another 15 minutes, and a 62-inch bull walked out 300 yards across the beach from camp.
No way.
It was chaos. Like, he's trying to put his gun together. That's putting his camera together. I'm like, "Throw me a microphone." He throws me a microphone. I'm miking myself, and the bull's sitting there watching us for like 2 minutes by the time we get ready, and he shoots it, and we got him. It was just like that, like nothing for the whole entire hunt, and we get one right from camp.
Oh, again, man.
Like 1 o'clock. You know, it was just crazy, you know, and it was a beautiful 62-inch moose. And, you know, I'll never forget that. You can never, ever quit, you know, because that moose could have been there, and just the calls brought him out, right? It just was just like that, right? Yeah. So exactly what you're saying, you know, you get a guy that quits on you, you just got to keep going because you never know what's going to happen. It can change in a matter of seconds, right?
It's crazy camp stories. And I guess that's part of the, I guess, benefit of getting right into moose territory and getting back into the backcountry and being in the thick of it pretty much. And back to, like, you just never know.
Yeah, we just don't. Like, it's so thick, they can just be right there and bam, they're out. You know, it's just like that. That's one of the best stories, and I tell that story to everybody, and I show them when they show up to my camp, right there, we got them. The guy quit on me, and we got him right there. So, you know, it just kind of gets that motivation that you can't quit, man. Like, and I have had guys that have tapped out and quit, and you, there's nothing you can do to change that mindset. Once that mindset's there, it's you know, you're done.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, it's tough.
It's funny because, like, him quitting almost, like, led him into success. And I would love to hear, like, his side of the story, what he tells people back home when he's telling his moose hunting story. You know what I mean?
Well, what he told me was, always listen to your guide. Never quit. Always listen to your guide. And, yeah, anyways. It absolutely. Because, you know, we jumped in river and we went up river. We might have not caught that bull, right? It was just meant to be, right? The way everything just unfolded.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, that's the thing too, you know, lots of my background is moose hunting, being up north in northern Manitoba. And, you know, I've been there, this kind of the same thing. Like, we were changing lights one day in our camp, we were changing some lights on the way to the outhouse and looked across the bay and there's a bull moose standing there. And a lot of times, like, when we come back to camp, we call from camp, we practice, and, you know, like, I don't get to moose hunt as much as, like, say my cousins and stuff, but, you know, you do those practice calls and doing some calls, and all of a sudden there's a moose standing there in the middle of the day. Like, you just never know. And, you know, one of my mentors is my cousin Quentin, and he always tells me, like, you cannot figure these things out. Like, they'll be where you least expect them, they'll be right where you think they're going to be. They're going to be everywhere and nowhere. And yeah. I always remember that. Like, you just cannot predict these things, like whitetail or like bears or elk or anything. Like, they're majestic, I guess, in a way. But to carry on to our framework of our podcast. So we're kind of now getting into, like, the nighttime of the guiding day. You've got it all day, and you already kind of talked about the meals and, you know, cooking up backstrap when you do get a moose on the ground. But what does your night look like when you get back to camp? Like, is it pretty much dinner and bed, or, like, what do you guys do there?
Yeah, pretty much. By the time we get in and we start cooking, by the time we eat, we're, like, at 10, 10:30, depending on what we cook, you know. We like to eat really deep up there, you know, pork chops or steaks or spaghetti, you know, with vegetables. So, like, well, somebody will be a dedicated cook. If you have a second guide or an assistant guide, then they'll fuel the boats up, grease the jets. The cameraman can help out too. Lots of times our camera guys throw in and help us out. So yeah, and then after we eat, sit around, socialize for a little bit. Clients go to bed. We clean up, do dishes, just because, you know, if you don't do the dishes, you got to deal with them the next day. Generally, you don't have time because it's, like I said, you're on repeat, right? So we do the dishes. By the time we hit the pillow, it could be 11, 1130, sometimes midnight. And then the alarm clock's going off, 5, 5:30, and you do it again, right? So there's not a, until you get an animal down, there's not a lot of time really to just, you know, unwind and just relax. Like you're on go all the time, right?
Yeah, for
you
sure.
You can kind of relax midday if you're sitting on a beach, just kind of calling or just, you know, whatever, trying to glass a section. But like I said, until that animal is actually taken, that's kind of when the relief is there. And now you're like, oh yeah, we get to sleep in tomorrow, you know? So
you have to
Cause your body does wear down with all those long days and not a lot of rest. And then you get an animal and then you have to be at camp the next day to process it, you know, to get it, sorry, not process it, to load it into the plane. And then, you know, you have to process some of it to eat, you know, like back straps or some guys will do ribs or tenderloin. And then, yeah, then you're kind of like, now you're hunting for predators once you get your animal down, unless you have another hunter or like if there's two hunters together, then you're still going. One group will go for a moose and the other group will focus on that kill site to, you know, maybe get a grizzly or wolves or something.
Crazy. Right. So you have to be, you're very strategic throughout the day and just like, even when you're resting somewhere, you're intentional about where you're going to park that boat and possibly get a moose coming across.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't nap. Some other guides will maybe have a siesta midday, but you know, let's, you know, you could have a nap and then that moose walks out in front and swims across the river and you're sleeping.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm always on until the animal's down. And then that's when I'm finally like, okay, now I can relax. We got an animal and now we're going to have a good time. And now we can, you know, depending on what day of the hunt it is, we can just, you know, just check the kill site and look for a predator. And it's, yeah, we've killed moose day two, day five, last day moose too. Right. So it varies within the hunt, right?
Yeah, you really have to be like a jack of all trades and really be some sort of like psychologist on some fronts to maintain the morale in camp when things are low. And obviously like chef, cleaner, and everything else. Have you ever had a guy come into camp where you're just like, man, this guy's not going to make it? Or does Jim do a pretty good job?
He'll never say. He'll never say.
Does Jim do a pretty good job of weeding out the guys?
We're pretty strategic with putting clients with physical abilities in the camps where it can suit them. Like if they have, you know, issues with walking or if they're elderly, then they'll go to a lake hunt, right? Argo camps are more for people that are able to take, you know, physical abuse and do some hiking. Jet boat hunts are a little bit, they're laid back, but they're still physical. But, you know, you can pretty much be in a wheelchair and not be mobile and still get a moose out of a lake hunt, out of a boat, as long as you can get into the boat.
I was kind of framing that question around like from a guide, that a new guide that may have showed up in camp.
Oh, a new guy.
Yeah.
Oh, not a client. Yeah, a couple. It's, you know, and they usually, if they can't cut it, they don't come back. Let's put it that way.
That's awesome. And then to kind of jump on top of that question from Chase, do you ever have the client that comes in that knows exactly what kind of you're going to do? And he's doing the calling and he wants to kind of call the shots, like, and you can kind of sit back and just watch what he does. You ever had that, or is it pretty much you're leading the way?
No, most of the time we set that out at the very beginning of the hunt. You know,
okay.
Here's gonna do. Here's the rules. Here's the safety rules, and this is how it's gonna go. And you always have to be in control. The minute you lose control, it's kind of a disaster coming, right?
Right.
Kind of a client calling the shots, and we've had clients that have come and that, yeah, they're expert hunters and they've done all of this stuff and they've done all that stuff, and then you find out after they've never actually hunted the wild. They've only hunted ranches. It's like, well, this is not a ranch, and you're not going to see hundreds of heads of elk here because this is the wild. You might see two moose, and one is the one you're going to shoot. So that's kind of a rude awakening for them, because they're used to seeing lots of game, and you might, like you guys just said, you might not see anything for 5 days, and then bam, there they are. It's just it's Mother Nature. It's the wild. We don't control it. We're just there along for the ride. We're trying to do everything we can.
Yeah.
In our power to get them their animal. But it is, at the end of the day, it's Mother Nature. It's, yeah, you know, like she's running the show. You're just trying to do the best you can with the means that you have and the tools that you have. But it's hunting, and there's no guarantees in hunting, as you guys know. You can't guarantee a moose hunt. You can't say, I will 100% get you a moose, because you can't. Like, it's hunting. It's, yeah, things sometimes are out of your control.
Yeah, I think we've all been there. I actually, Chase came out to my place a few weeks ago, and I said, yeah, we're going to shoot a bunch of ducks, blah, blah, blah. Got them on this great duck field, and we didn't even shoot a duck. So we all have that. You can never predict. You can never say for sure you're gonna shoot something. But kind of to round up this day of the life of a guide, before we sit down and by the fire and ask you some more rapid fire questions, I gotta ask you, at the end of the day, what are those foods that you guys are eating? Like, I know you talked about a lot of stuff, but what, by the time you're leaving camp, what are you craving? I know you said that you have a dry camp and stuff, like you might want a beer, but like, is there anything that you guys don't have at camp where you're wanting to get it once you get out?
Salad. We have no veggies because veggies don't hold in the cold. So,
oh, yeah.
Minute I get out to Whitehorse, I'm asking for a Greek salad, a Caesar salad, and beer. I want some veggies because you're eating protein and you're eating canned goods, and you know, it's stuff that's gonna keep, right?
Right.
Vegetables don't keep, right? Like, fruit doesn't keep for a long period of time. So yeah, salad is on my number one, and a couple pints of beer for sure.
Nice. Where do you call home? Where's home for you right now?
Terrace, British Columbia. So I'm in the north coast of BC. I'm an hour and a half inland from Prince Rupert. So the ocean's not that far from us, and Alaska is right there too. It's Stewart, Hyder, Alaska is not that far from where I am. About a 3 hour drive.
Nice.
So now we're sitting by the fire, end of the camp or the guide day for old Stevie. We got a couple questions here to kind of fire at you before we end this podcast. Anybody that's watched the Uncharted series might know about the chicken.
The
rubber chicken. Let's hear about it.
Okay, so the rubber chicken, it came into conception in 2017, because we had when we started this journey for the show Yukon Uncharted that is now on the air, we started this process in 2014. So the first series, it was a pilot series, was called The Outfit, and then the second season we came back and we started another one called Rogue River Men, because the territory we guide for is called Rogue River Outfitters. So when we were, you know, the production crew was pitching this to the Outdoor Channel with Jim and stuff, and the Outdoor Channel was just like, yeah, it's just not edgy enough. It's just not reality TV, you know, and they wanted something more. So 2017, when we started Yukon Uncharted, we needed some drama, and so that's how the rubber chicken came in, and I was going to get the rubber chicken no matter what. The minute that came into the concept came out, Wojo, who's our chief operations manager for the whole outfit, was like, you're gonna get this chicken no matter what. And I was like, I don't want the chicken, man. Like, you can't just give it to me. He's like, chicken is yours. And it was like, so I was doomed from the beginning. I didn't even leave Whitehorse yet, and the chicken was mine already. And so they were just looking for something, and then I got it because in 2016 when we shut camp down, we were doing a rush job because the plane was coming early, and I delegated to another senior guide, you know, the boat job, because I was taking care of the tents, I was taking care of the stoves, I was putting everything away. So I had three tents, two propane stoves, chimney, and we create them. Plus, I had the wall tent and the cook stove in there and the wood stove. So I had a lot on my plate, so I delegated it. And with four strokes, you got to make sure they're on the right side, because if you don't put them on the right side, then the oil will leak down into the cylinders, and over time, like, we're talking a whole entire season here. Like, we shut camp down in end of September. We come back, you know, late August, early September. So it's a whole entire year almost that these motors are laying on their side under a boat. So all that oil will fill the cylinder, and then you can't get the pistons to move because they're locked with all that oil. So that's what happened. One motor was on the right side, one motor was on the wrong side, but I, as the head guy, didn't physically double check to make sure it was done right. I got the rubber chicken for that. But I ended up getting the motor running. So I just took the spark plugs out and just kept pulling the motor over until all the oil was out, and then, you know, put a little bit of fuel down the cylinders, put the plugs back in, fired it up. It smoked like a bastard for forever, just until all that oil finally got burnt out of the cylinders, but it ran fine for the whole entire season. But I got the chicken because of that.
that's a messy job, man. We were just talking about that.
Right? So.
Yeah, definitely.
My next question around the fire here, you just mentioned Wojo, and it's funny because my old man talks about watching Jim Shockey videos and Wojo being in some of them and stuff, and the guy seems like he's very organized, but at the same time maybe a hard ass, and at the same time likes to have the odd beer. I know you're not going to talk shit about your you know, guy in command, but give us a couple lines about Wojo.
Well, see, all that stuff you see on TV, it's 100% for TV. Like, Wojo he's definitely the boss, so you don't want to screw up, because if you screw up, you're gonna get in shit for sure. But you got to pretty much do a big screw up. Where, you know, Wojo is a great person. He's a softy. And, you know, he's been there forever, like since the beginning when I started. He was just a guide like me. He wasn't the boss. But no, that's just TV makes him look like he's a tough, hard boss, and he's riding me to, you know, but that's not really what it's like, you know. So he's a really kind man. You know, it's just that's what the whole TV thing is, yeah. You know. Dramatized to make it so everybody likes you, right? So
yeah, I'm interested in kind of hearing, I don't know if Sheldon is prepared for this conversation yet, but like, obviously all the hunting and stuff that you were talking about back in 2014 15 16 kind of thing, and nowadays the latest news is that Jim Shockey is now kind of hanging up the camera, I guess you could say, or whatever it may be. What's your plan now? What's on the docket for you?
Well, the outfits continues to go. Just the only thing that's been kind of shelved has been his hunting adventure show. So that's kind of now finished. And then the Yukon Uncharted is finished. You know, we did two seasons, but the producers are still trying to pitch it, because it is a very popular show. And it's, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's all about finances. So if they can meet the network, you know, somewhere, maybe it will continue on. I know that discussions are ongoing right now. So hopefully it is resurrected and it's not the end, because a lot of feedback we're getting is it's one of the best shows out there and everybody loves it because it's real. It's not contrived. You know, it's real people, real struggles. You know, and it's the reality of guiding. It's not like you just get to go out there and shoot an animal and there's a show, right? It, there's a lot of highs and lows, as you guys said. But what I can say is that Jim is not done. He has created a new show that's going to start on the Outdoor Channel in January. It's called Shock Therapy. And it's similar to what you guys are doing, but it's television-based. It's a podcast, television show, interview style. And they flash back to previous hunts. So a lot of the stuff I talked about today with you guys, they'll be showcasing some of those hunts in this show. And it's just like, the guest Jim will have on his show, you know, Cody Robbins will be one of them, and they'll talk about the good old days, and they'll flash back to those hunts. And
that's a cool, that's a very cool concept.
Yeah. So that's starting in January. And I was down in Vancouver Island about 2 weeks ago, and I shot a couple shows with Jim about the whole Yukon thing that we just discussed today on this podcast. And so that's going to start in January, and looking forward to seeing the new show. So but for myself, with COVID this year, we were pretty much shut down, so I didn't get to guide, but I got to hunt for myself, which I didn't get to do for, you know, many years. So that was a positive. And we'll see what happens next year. Hopefully the world kind of gets back to like a normal pace, and we'll just, you know, take it a day at a time and see what happens. But, you know, if I can get back guiding, I will. And if I can't because of whatever is going on, then I'll hopefully get out hunting for myself again.
That's wild, man. It certainly is wild times right now. What, do you have anything on the side on the go through these slow times, or how are you kind of, what are you keeping busy with?
I got two kids. My life is not slow. And, you know, I got a 2-year-old and a 9-year-old, so life is busy.
Oh, buddy, you're preaching to the choir right now. I got a 1.5-year-old and a 3-year-old at home, and the way things kind of rolled out for me through COVID, and I've kind of made some major life changes, and I am now the stay-at-home father, and they definitely keep you on your toes. There's not too many dull moments throughout the day.
Yeah, I was doing the same thing and homeschooling and everything. It was pretty chaotic here for that March, April, May, June bit. But hopefully things will be better for next year.
That's wild. Are you out chasing anything else right now besides now that you're putting in time for yourself?
I got home actually just a couple days ago from a local moose hunt here, and got my local moose, and my friend got one. So we got two. So they're not trophy hunts at all. It's you see any bull, you pull the trigger, and it's 100%, you know, putting the meat in the freezer and feeding the family. So we got our we got a couple bulls, and so we're good. So that's pretty much it, like I said, until January. You know, I may go bison hunting, I may not, depends on what happens, but that's pretty much it for now. Right now, just just unpacking and cleaning up for my moose hunt.
Nice.
So the day life of the guide, we're kind of the fire's going out. We're going to get to the end of this podcast, but I got a couple more questions for you. And one that I got to ask, not only from the show, but you mentioned earlier in the podcast, is that you guys do donate some meat to the First Nations that are in maybe in your allocation where you guys are hunting. How does that work? If you want to talk about it, and what does it mean to you, like, to give back to the community or to the people that are around that land?
Well, generally, a lot of, you know, hunters, if they choose to take the meat, they can. It's, you know, but a lot of our clients fly. Some will drive. The ones that drive will take their meat home. The ones that fly, they want, you know, the experience. They want to hunt. They want to taste the meat. You know, they may take a little bit home and a little cooler. But like I said, these things are ginormous, these animals, right? So so they usually donate it to the local First Nations band. And I think not this past year, but, you know, the last year was 2019, I think we donated 18,000 pounds of moose.
Wow.
The band. They get quite a bit of meat from us. And, you know, like I said, it's up to the client if they want to take it. And then the guides, Some guides will take it home if they drive. Some guides fly, so they're not able to. But I usually will take, you know, a full cooler home and, you know, feed my family with it because I don't get to hunt. So at least I get some moose meat for the season. But yeah, no, it's definitely, we utilize the whole animal, and we're not just taking, the meat. A lot of times we'll pull some organs out, you know, for the local First Nations, you know, like liver, heart, whatever, you know, whatever they want, whatever we can get that's easy and accessible. And we'll get that, you know, back to their float plane base and back to them as quick as possible so that it doesn't spoil. Right. So we're very, very, quick to get meat out so that it doesn't sour and bears or it doesn't attract problems. So, generally within 24 hours of the animal going down, it's out of our camp.
Yeah.
So we're quite quick on that.
Yeah, for sure. And I know like a lot of, outfitters in Manitoba, the same thing, like they do a lot of donations. They donate a lot of meat to, food banks, First Nations, etc. So that's super cool, and it's one of those things as hunters in Canada, you know, when you have people coming up here and hunting and using our resources, it's nice to share with everyone. So I think that's a super notable thing to do. And my last question, and this is going to be, you know, one of those things where it's going to be hit or miss, but you know, you're having a tough day in the Moose Woods or the Moose River or the Moose Lake. What is the one thing that you're going to throw in your arsenal to get that bull moose to come out? If it's a cow call, bull call, raking trees, like what's that one thing that you think that's going to work?
I generally alternate. I usually will start with a cow call, and it depends. If I know if there's a bull there and he's got a cow, then I'll go to a paddle. I'll use a bull paddle and I'll rake, because that generally will fire him up. But I usually start with a cow call, and then if I don't know anything's there, I just alternate every 20 minutes. I'll do a couple rakes with the paddle and I'll switch back to a cow call. But if I know something's there and I've seen something, then you know I can kind of gauge what I'm going to use, right? But it's if a bull's got a cow, you can try the cow call, but 9 times out of 10, you start raking. And if you get into his bubble, if you can get into 50 yards without spooking him, you can start raking at 50 yards, you're going to get him going, and he's going to come home.
Ooh, that's tight.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, you got to get into their bubble. And that's most of the times is when you get into their bubble, you really get those bulls fired up, eh? Because now you're in the zone, and he doesn't like it. He doesn't want you to take his cow, right?
Yeah.
So, but and if you watch a lot of the stuff with Jim in the high country, you can read these bulls because you're seeing what they're doing. But when you're down low, if you can only see what's kind of portions of what's going on, you got to kind of just try to see what you can do, right?
Yeah. And that to be honest with you, when Chase and I were elk hunting this year, just to kind of put one thing to another, we were chasing elk, bull elk, obviously, in the Interlake Woods. It's a thick woods. And we would call, locate, we'd find where this bull is, and we'd actually go up after him and keep calling, cow calling. And we get into that 100 to whatever, 100 to 75 yard range and calling. And then all of a sudden that bull would just snap and he would like come after us, basically like calling, coming to us. And that's what we found was very successful. Like we get into that, just like you said, that bubble. With the bull moose, but like for us it was that bull elk, and he would just like, okay, that's enough, like you're not getting any closer, and he started challenging us, and man, it was super cool. We never got one this year, but we sure learned a lot being newer elk archery hunters. But
yeah, it's pretty much the same, but you know, elk they're similar.
Yeah.
Similar, the elk have I think a larger herd than the moose, you know, but very similar.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, we're going to, you know, kind of get to a conclusion on this podcast. Chase, do you have anything else to ask, talk to Steve about, whatever you got?
I think I'm pretty good, man. Like, I don't know, just want to say thanks, Steve, for coming out and joining us for, and taking the time to join us for this episode. Certainly gives us a look into your life and kind of how things operate around just a high pressure camp, we'll say, for like, I mean, you're talking trophy moose, you're talking high end clients, and you're talking people that can push the dollars to go and do this, and it's a bit of a different world in some senses, and it's we just got a little peek into it here, just chatting with you. So thank you for that.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, for sure. And Steve, if you have anything else to say, I'm just gonna kind of finish off by saying thanks a lot for coming on. Same as Chase. Like I said at the start of the podcast, you know, it was like a couple messages back and forth on Instagram. If you guys want to look for Steve on Instagram, it's Steve Pereira, and look him up on Instagram. He's got a wicked site. But yeah, like, thanks for coming on. And this hunting community that we have is super tight, and I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, there's not much more else I can say, except for I want you to come on again and again, because I have a lot more questions when it comes to moose hunting. I'm not maybe as decorative as you are when it comes to moose hunting. But yeah, thanks for coming. And if you have anything else to say, it's time to say it.
No, that's pretty much it. I've been super blessed to do this for the last 12 years. And, you know, like I said, first moose I actually got to see in the Yukon was a 67.5, and you know, the biggest one I guided was 68, and you know, that was 2015, so only a half an inch bigger. But you know, I've got to see, you know, monsters up there, and I've guided pretty much every animal except the only animal I was never successful on was that sheep hunt with Jim. That's the only animal in the Yukon I didn't see harvested. But besides that, you know, grizzly bears, wolf, moose, caribou, even a wolverine we got 1 year out of camp. So I've got to see a lot of amazing things and live a pretty cool life and experience some neat things. So it's been amazing. So
whoa, wait here, Steve. So what you're saying is on your job, like, application, on your job interview, you didn't get the sheep, but yet you shot all, or got all these other animals.
Yeah. We never got a sheep, but every other animal that we have in the Yukon, I've been part of, you know, caribou and grizzly and wolf and moose, and like I said, even a wolverine we got too. So that was pretty spectacular, because you never see a wolverine really. So yeah. Yeah, it's been absolutely just amazing experience.
Well, that's awesome, Steve, and it's really nice to hear that, like, guys like you really appreciate it and like soak it all in and know kind of what you got out there. Big thanks again, and hopefully we'll chat with you in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Look forward to it.
Thanks for listening in to episode 65, folks. We hope you enjoyed that one. I know we sure did. If you guys are out in the field this week, we wish you luck. It's general white-tailed deer season just opened up here in Manitoba. So wherever you're listening from, we hope you're shooting straight out there. And Tristan, you got anything you want to say before we wrap it up?
Yeah, just turning our minds just the holiday season here. As we prepare for that season, things looking differently for sure for a lot of us. Word on the street is that there might be a backup at Canada Post, just because of the way they've had to adapt their business model and with sick days and all that kind of stuff. So our recommendation on our end, if you're interested in getting a hat or a piece of merch for someone special this holiday season, try to get it in sooner than later. That way that piece is under the tree on time, wrapped, and you're not like me scrambling last minute.
Yeah, we've actually had a few Christmas orders come in already, and so some people are getting on top of it, but if you guys are looking for something, come and get it.
I wish I was that organized.
Yeah, I'm definitely not. Sheldon, you have any final before we wrap this one up?
Yeah, man, I really, like I said in the intro and stuff, and probably throughout it, I was pretty happy to have Steve on. It's really great to get you know, people on from all over this country and wherever they are in this world. So for us to get people on, you know, like Steve and a lot of other ones, we need the support from our listeners. So we, you know, thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen. And if you do have a little bit extra time, we appreciate to get a, you know, 5 stars, a comment, or just, you know, like our post on social media and keep this train rolling. We, like I said, we appreciate every one of you guys and the folks out there listening. We can't ask for any more. So thank you very much.
Right on. Yeah. Smash that like button, share the podcast, and give us that rating. And thanks again for Steve coming on. Man, great guy. I think we're going to probably reach out to him and have him back on in the future to talk about some other big game stuff possibly. And once again, folks, we hope you're having some success out in the field.
Be sure to tag us in your photos there as you have luck in the field. Always awesome to see what our listeners are up to.
Tag us in the gear too,
for sure. We love it. So be sure to keep an edge on that knife of yours, keep your powder dry and your lines tight.